Greetings from Long Island, where every highway is a sunrise. It's time for Dave's Gone By, an hour of comedy, talk, and music brought to you by Total Theater, with your host, Dave Lefkowitz. You've never heard anything like it, so sit back, relax, squeal if you must. Here's the host of Dave's Gone By, Dave!
Tropical hot dog night! Like two flamingos in a fruit fight! Every color of day! Swirling around at night!
Well, there goes the Daverhood! Welcome to the 142nd edition of Dave's Gone By, brought to you by Hewlett Minuteman Press, The Copy Kings, and by Total Theater's Performing Arts Insider magazine, Broadway, the best way. And the best way I can think of introducing my guest tonight is by letting him do it himself. Well, mostly. I need to preface. More than a decade ago, I visited Chicago with the American Theater Critics Association. It's a guild of sorts of people who write about theater from all over the country. And every year, we go to different cities and sample what's going on in their regional theaters. Places like L.A. and Dallas-Fort Worth and Louisville and the Berkshires, that kind of thing. Anyway, Chicago is such a vibrant and active theater town. There were dozens and dozens of shows to see. And often we all split up on our own agendas just to try and catch as much as we could while we were there. And I was so staggered by the amount of activity in Chicago theater, I actually went back again to see more a couple of weeks later. As industrious as New York is off and off Broadway, Chicago, especially at that time, was just a beehive. And a critic friend of mine living there, Mary Shen Barnage, who writes for The Reader and the Windy City Times, she said, well, you know, you have to go see Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. And I was like, what? She said, Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. It's a late night show on the weekends. It's all young people who go out there and, I'm not going to tell you anymore, just go see it. And I did. I trusted Mary's judgment. And I am not one for staying up late and getting out of a theater at 1 in the morning, but she was so insistent, and the idea seemed so intriguing. 30 plays in 60 minutes. And the title, too. And besides, it was just an hour. I can take an hour of weirdness, especially when I was younger. So, after my early show that night, I cabbed over to see the Neo-Futurists, that's what they call themselves, the Neo-Futurists, and they were doing Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. If I say the experience was revelatory, that it changed the way I look at theater, that it expanded the idea of what I thought live performance felt like, that would not be an exaggeration. I've had only precious few experiences like that in my theater-going life, and I have seen thousands of shows. I've been a theater critic for 20 years, a theater journalist for a long time, and I generally prefer a well-structured, gripping, or funny full-length play, or a lively, emotionally involving musical. There is room for something else. Now, granted, most something else's lose their way very quickly. They're pretentious or unfathomable or just different without being interesting. But every once upon a miracle, magic happens. For me, those magical confluences were Blue Man Group, Full Moon, and Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. Times where I truly came out of the theater with a spirit of joy, a sense of wonder. But how does Too Much Light work? I mean, what makes it different from just an evening of short one acts or sketch comedy or improv? Well, it's the whole experience from the minute you walk in the door. Here's Greg Allen, founder of the Neo-Futurists, explaining how it all happens.
Hello and welcome to Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, an ever-changing attempt to perform 30 plays in 60 minutes. I'm Greg Allen, the guy who created the show in Chicago back in 1988, where it is still running to this day. Here's how the show works on stage. You enter the theater. You are handed a menu of the 30 plays for that evening and told to order by number. A clock is set for 60 minutes and begun with a countdown, which varies vastly from the way they do it at Cape Canaveral. Each play begins with the word go and ends with the word curtain, which is then your cue to call out the number of the play you want to see next. If you pictured this properly, you realize that all hell breaks loose for 60 minutes or so, during which time you are subjected to a random barrage of tragic, comic, poetic, socio-political, experimental, what-the-whiz-that plays about your life before a heinous buzzer goes off. That's the clock saying time's up. We don't like to hear that. A tradition at our theater is when we sell out, we order out. Pizza, that is. Only you can determine if you have a sold-out house, but you might want to call a pizza place or pop one in the oven before starting. We also stop the clock for death or pizza, so don't feel bashful about doing so, especially for the former. Well, I think that's about all you need to know. Have a good show.
Greg Allen there from a CD put out by the Neo-Futurists almost a decade into their run. And even from that intro, even from the playlets you hear on the CD, and I'll share a couple over the course of the show, you get some idea of what makes the performance unique, but you really have to go and see it for yourself to understand. If you live in Chicago, it is still running there every weekend at the Neo-Futurarium, and a branch company is coming back to New York this fall. They're still picking the theater, but in a couple of weeks, the Neo-Future will be upon us. But we get a preview tonight, September 15th, because our special guest is Greg Allen, the voice you just heard, talking more about this very special, amazing type of theater, about his other creative work, including the last 2 minutes of the complete works of Henrik Ibsen. And in our last few minutes, I also have a brand new song to sing about the hurricane. Oh, yes. This could only be Dave's Gone By, an hour of comedy, talk radio, and music hosted by me, Dave Lefkowitz, theater critic, journalist, humorist, and neo-futurist enthusiast. We'll be back to shed some light, too much light, after this. Dave's Gone By listeners know I love a good play on words, but let me say a good word on plays, my plays, collected in a lovely book called Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, comedies that range from strange to deranged, from sad to satirical, fun, and unmistakably Dave. Just $20 hardcover, $12 soft. Put down that crappy bestseller and pick up some laughs. 516-295-1511 or davesgoneby.org for Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World.
Why can't I be good?
D is for Dave, F is for fun, S is for silly and special, X is for excellent entertainment, DFSX Internet Radio, playing vintage episodes of Dave's Gone By, Thursday nights at 8 and 11. It's part of Live 365, but all you gotta do is visit davesgoneby.org, click the link, and listen online to classic Dave's Gone By, Thursdays 8 and 11. DFSX, letters that stand for terrific!
The idea of you? Go.
I called you up and I said, how were you and could I please speak to the idea of you? You said, excuse me? I said, I didn't call to talk to you. I called to talk to the idea of you. I said I'd been doing some thinking. I had realized that all the time we'd been seeing each other, it was really the idea of you I wanted to go out with. You asked me how I had come to this astonishing conclusion. I said, oh, little things tipped me off. The way you knocked over your water glass on Wednesday when the idea of you was grace and ease. The way you fumbled for words on Sunday when the idea of you always knew what to say. I said I always understood the idea of you, but lately you were beginning to confuse me. There was a pause as you handed over the receiver, and then a voice came on the line that reminded me of you, but without those annoying glitches and halts. We talked for a few moments in what felt like a carefree, ideal way, and then the idea of you asked to speak to the idea of me. I asked for clarification of this bizarre suggestion, and it asserted that the idea of me was too sensitive and intelligent to reject the human imperfections of someone I loved. Sensing that I had somehow dropped the ball, I nobly stepped aside so that the idea of us could live happily ever after. Kurt.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. I've got a legend on the phone with me, probably a legend that you've all heard of or read in the papers every single day or seen monumentalized, but in the world of theater and in the world of theater that I've seen, this man created something that was one of the greatest experiences in the theater that I have ever had. And remember, I'm a theater critic. I've seen thousands of shows, and I was in Chicago several years ago, back in the late 1980s, and was brought down there with a bunch of theater critics, and a theater critic friend says, you know, you've got to see this late night show. It's different, it's special, it's lively, it's fun, it's unlike anything you've ever seen. You have to see it. Went there, I think it was 11:30 curtain, and didn't know what to expect, and then came out about an hour or 75 minutes later, changed, and completely revitalized and excited about the possibilities of art and theater. And the man who created that experience, called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, is with us on the phone, Greg Allen. Hey, Greg.
Hi there. That's quite the intro, dude.
Well, I'm sure you've had people tell you that your show, or the show that you concocted with the neo-futurists, just did something to them that they don't get 99.9% of the time when they go to the theater. Am I right?
It is a very different experience altogether. Certainly a different theatrical experience, a different experience than one kind of gets in any performance art, any sporting event, any live event. So I honestly have heard a number of people say, "Wow, are there other things like this elsewhere?" And people tend to feel like it's fairly one of a kind, and I'm proud of that.
I mean, you could say, or people who haven't seen the show would say, well, wait a minute, it just sounds like some very, very short plays, like a bunch of one acts done really quickly, like sketches. And what's so special about that, and that doesn't really cover it, that isn't it. Well, the genesis of this, please tell us, because it is steeped in some theater theory. It isn't just like random goofy fun that you thought up. You were studying about this.
It's very much coming from my own background in theater history, theater theory. Obviously, we call ourselves the neo-futurists, updating the Italian futurist aesthetic.
You might as well explain what that is.
Yeah, the Italian futurists were a group of avant-garde artists, mainly painters, sculptors around pre-World War I Italy and into the World War I, who believed in speed, dynamism, violence, mechanization, all these things that the future was going to bring, which were at the time were kind of being shunned, and people were saying, oh, no, this is bad. They were the movement, the first avant-garde theater movement, certainly of the 20th century, who said, let's embrace this stuff and grab it and run forward into the chaos. And so they did exactly that. They created these very short pieces based on upsetting the audience, on counteracting their expectations, and these elements, audience participation as well, these elements are still very much a part of neo-futurism as it's come to be known, along with elements of Dada and surrealism and Fluxus and environmental art, all kind of thrown together, concocted together into this immediate event aesthetic that we've come to know as neo-futurism.
And what was the process by which you went from saying, oh, okay, I want to do something along these lines, I'm influenced by these kinds of things, into shaping that for what would become Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind and having the theater group, the neo-futurists, do it?
I've been influenced by this stuff ever since I ran across it at Oberlin in college. In fact, I actually mounted a number of original Italian futurist plays in an evening at Oberlin, and it went over just kind of gangbusters, and I thought, hey, there's really something here. And so not only did the actual plays that the Italian futurists put together inspire me, but their manifestos are these incredible firebrands of just endless esoteric gobbledygook that they throw at you very quickly and kind of are batting you about the head with, and just trying to acknowledge what it is they're after and embrace that was very inspiring. It wasn't people sitting down very quietly and writing a nice little thesis about what they thought theater should be. It was very much kind of this very upsetting, aggressive stance, which I really liked. They were very much in favor of burning down the museums and wiping everything in the history of theater off the map. So it was very exciting for a 20-year-old kid to come across at college. And then that kind of meshed with my own beliefs my own feelings really of going to theater is I always felt like people were not taking theater for what its best use was, that the actual visceral experience, and the reason most everyone goes to theater, doesn't go to the movies, doesn't go to sit home and watch television, mm-hmm. because you want a visceral, immediate experience with human beings in the same room. And I would go to theater, and I was very much a theater fan and a bit of an actor and writer, and I would see theater that was basically the same thing as movies, same thing as television. It was very much about suspending the audience's disbelief, very much about creating this artifice on stage that you would sit in the dark and take in and experience. And to me, theater was so much more about actually interacting with an audience, very much reflecting the immediacy of the times and the actual lives of the people in the room, which would be both the audience and the performers. So I very much latched on to this anti-artifice aesthetic, which, once again, kind of neo-futurism is based on. Mm-hmm. And that combined with the idea of the Italian futurists in terms of audience participation, very short plays in a very short amount of time, simultaneity, the unknown, all different elements kind of came together and ultimately folded into become pretty much Lightning the Baby Go Blind.
And how did you find people who shared that aesthetic? I mean, it wasn't just looking for typical actors and writers to say, hey, let's form a theater group. I mean, how didn't you really come up with that first core of people who joined you?
It's so much based on kind of being who you are, where you are, and just having the guts to stand up and express yourself in a creative way. That I really, it's interesting because when I started the show in 1988, started the company, mm-hmm. I was really up for taking anybody, really. There was one performer I'd done a performance art piece with before. There were a couple people from the parent theater group there. There was someone who worked with me at the bookstore who was a singer, and just a really cool woman. I just thought she should do it. You know? I just found people who were crazy enough to kind of follow me in this endeavor and see what came of it. And, you know, it was very low stakes. We were opening a show at 11:15. It would be performed on Fridays and Saturdays, and it was the first late-night show in Chicago. And
oh, my goodness.
We split the door sadly we didn't even split the door. We got a very small percentage of the door at the time. And there was basically no cost. It's a very much poor theater aesthetic, and it doesn't cost anything to go out on stage and express your thoughts and your experiences in a very immediate way and creatively to an audience, just very rapid fire.
Do you remember any sketches or any moments from that very first night that you did?
I guess the one that really sticks in my mind is King Lear. I did a deconstruction of King Lear. Where at one point I would go out, I'm trying to remember.
Sure.
I would go out and ask the audience if they loved me. and if the audience member responded yes, I would give them an article of my clothing so that as a thank you. So like the first person who said yes, I would give them my shoes, and I would give someone else my shirt, and then my socks, and then my pants, and I'd ultimately get down to my underwear and go up to somebody, and I was kind of acting blind at this point too, so I wasn't really looking at them, but I was just standing there. And I had already been kind of abused in the first and second acts that led up to this point. And I would go up to someone in the audience and I would say, do you love me? And they would know that if they said yes, I would be completely nude on stage, hand them in my underwear, which often happened. I do remember opening night definitely being nude. And it was one of the more successful moments I think I've created in a piece, because it's very funny at first, and then it's just really awful because you realize that Lear is exchanging everything he has for love, and ultimately is victimized by his own stripping away. So that was just a moment of the opening night. I remember we also finished with about a minute and 20 seconds left on the clock. And since our endeavor was to perform 30 plays in 60 minutes, it was great to do it opening night since we'd never really done it before.
Wow. And it's funny because some of the themes, even in that very sketch you mentioned, are recurring with your kind of work all through. I mean, I remember seeing you, not quote-unquote, nude in another scene where you just sort of came out on stage naked. That was like the first or second time I saw Too Much Light. And I was like, what is this? Why, you know, we were watching these playlets and suddenly you're just standing on stage naked. I'm like, oh, great. You know, and you're saying, well, and you're talking to the audience. And, yes, you notice, what are you looking at? What are you not looking at?
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, great. You know, I couldn't have seen this one with Anne Halliday playing it. I have to see Greg Allen playing this one. I was like, lucky me.
But, yeah. Well, that's, I don't do that so much anymore. I'm older now. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, when you're exploring kind of a stripped down
aesthetic, yeah.
That wasn't intentional. But when you're exploring a stripped down aesthetic where it's pretty much about living beings, just real people dealing with their own issues on stage, there are all sorts of powerful things you can do that just through conversation, just through presence, elicits an amazing response from an audience without having to have all the theatrical rigmarole of costumes and stuff, all that kind of stuff. And of course, the most obvious one is you take off your clothes and you immediately get a response. And that's kind of what that piece is about. That was called Exposed, actually.
And also, there's the deconstruction aspect of literature, because the thing that you're just finished doing at the New York International Theater Festival this year in New York was a deconstruction of Ibsen, if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I actually tend to be very adaptive in my work. I tend to use the works of somebody. I have trouble starting with blank slate, hence King Lear, hence I've done shows based on Kafka's The Trial, based on Samuel Beckett's work, George Orwell's work, the artist Joseph Cornell, Marcel Duchamp. I've done five deconstructions of King Lear to this point. And the most recent one was the last 2 minutes of the complete works of Henrik Ibsen at the New York Fringe Festival, where I literally took, and actually when I embarked on this, I had no idea how many plays the guy actually cranked out, but 26 plays as it turns out. Nobody's basically heard of anything before Peter Ginn.
Right.
And there were 10 plays in there, which no one has, have hardly even been translated out of the original Norwegian. So it was great to kind of uncover these obscure plays and look at their last 2 minutes, along with the ends of masterpieces like Hedda Gabler and the Wild Duck, all these. As well as I've always been a fan of Ibsen and for his later expressionist work as well, in terms of When We Dead Awake and Little Eyolf.
Well, what do we learn from Ibsen just by watching his last 2 minutes?
Oh, I mean, the first thing that really attracted me to doing this project was Ibsen is just a king of the thunderous ending. I mean, he's all these plays come to this amazing climax at the end of the show. I've got two avalanches, a couple suicides, people throw themselves off a bridge, someone falls off a tower. Someone goes, a number of mad scenes, of course, murders, it's amazing. And Ibsen, like, I mean, classic, of course, is Hedda Gabler. There's the gunshot.
Right.
Good God, people don't do such things. Curtain. I mean, that's it. Sustainable whatsoever. So really, I mean, when you look at all 26 plays, Ibsen was amazing at constructing these plays that built up to these feverish finales, and then just whammo, that then just ended with a curtain.
Right.
So just as a dramatist, I thought it was really fascinating to approach Ibsen as, you know, just let's look at the climaxes and bag all the exposition and the characters build up and all that stuff. Let's just go climax to climax to climax. And so it was great fun to deal with those things. And yet he also is very much a product of his time and his place. I mean, of course, grew up in Norway, actually, then he was an expatriate in Rome writing most of his life. But the themes of snow and of being isolated, the sun and the moon figure very heavily in his work. All sorts of, almost all the plays have some mention of freedom. It's really fascinating when you look at the entire oeuvre of Ibsen's work. And then also I do them in chronological order so that you see both him getting better as a dramatist. Also, I mean, here's a guy who started with kind of the well-made play, basically, and had started with all these kind of Norwegian folk tales, and then slowly built up towards the height of his poetic elements, or his poetic style with Peer Gynt and Brand, and then suddenly moves into realism, which nobody had done at the time, and moves out of kind of melodrama into, you know, kitchen sink drama, basically, and then finally kind of goes off the deep end into expressionism. So here's someone whose life's work kind of arcs through all these different forms as well. It's fascinating to see how he changes. And so the stagings I have for each of the plays also kind of mirror such things. The staging, the mounting of the show actually parallels the history of theater, kind of starting with the storyteller, then the one actor, then the two actors, through puppet shows, and then slowly moving on until kind of, you know, almost a beckoning play at the end.
Okay, listen to me. No, I mean, listen to me on Compact Disc, where bunches of past episodes of Dave's Gone By are yours to hear over and over again. Comedy sketches like The Bad Dad Elections and Handyman Yoni, visits with guests like Reckless Eric and Julie Haggerty, punchlines and politics in The News Gone By, all just $12 a disc, shipping included. Visit davesgoneby.org or call 516-295-1511 for me on CD. What's playing on Broadway? I'll tell you what's playing on Broadway, and I'll do it by checking Performing Arts Insider. Off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, off-off-off-Broadway. You keep adding offs, they'll keep adding listings. Who's in the cast? What's it about? Why is it special? Performing Arts Insider is Broadway the best way. 516-295-1511. 516-295-1511. Or see PerformingArtsInsider.com.
Hi, this is Greg Allen, the founding director of the Neo-Futurists, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
Did you ever try your hand at something that was, we would consider, standard theater? Did you ever write a full-length play that was in the tradition of, well, Aristotle or Aristophanes, for that matter?
I keep trying to, but I just can't do it. It's very frustrating. I've written about 25 full-length plays to date, and I keep trying not to implicate either myself or the actors immediately performing the show. But see, it seems like I can't quite get away from the authentic reality of what I'm dealing with, that this is a part that is written for this couple that I created. I created a show a couple years ago called Evidence, where I intentionally cast a couple, a boyfriend-girlfriend, and another guy who happened to be called Tim. So I had two Tims and an Emily. So then, of course, as I was creating the piece, it wound up being very much using the relationship of Tim and Emily, and then the fact that there was another Tim there let me have this kind of doppelganger that I could throw back and forth. And so once again, it became inseparable from the actors performing the piece. So that's kind of the element that often gets in the way of my pieces being picked up and performed elsewhere.
Well, let me
unless you cast two other guys named Tim and one of their girlfriends named Emily.
Right. So, well, there was that point, wasn't there some show where it was specifically tailored for like some actor? It was even a comedy piece, and maybe it was defending the and someone else did it. making believe that he was the original guy. And it apparently worked. It went okay.
Yeah,
maybe it was defending the caveman or something like that.
No, really. I don't know about that. Oh, that is true. There are people who step in for that role, don't they? Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's totally possible and plausible, and I would encourage people to read my work and look at it. Actually, I have a couple of people who are interested in doing Ibsen, the last minute complete works of Ibsen after I'll leave here, and that's something that definitely kind of the rights to which can be picked up elsewhere. Actually, evidence can too. It would just have an interesting non-neo-futurist twist to it, where it kind of loses that immediate veracity of what's going on. There are also always audience interactive moments in my shows, which are obviously pretty open-ended. I mean, I just have to kind of scenario it, and whoever would be directing it and performing it would just have to deal with it in the moment.
Well, getting back to Too Much Light, which has been running in Chicago pretty much nonstop since 1988, and it's had one or two sojourns in New York off Broadway, and it looks like it will have another one in the fall.
Yeah, I came out here in April of 2004. Four? Three? I don't know. I'm losing track. Yeah, no, 2004 came out and opened a branch of Neo-Futurist to perform Too Much Light, Makes Baby Go Blind in Brooklyn, where we performed for 6 months. Then we performed in Manhattan for the next 6 months at the Belt Theater, which unfortunately is being turned into a restaurant. Hmm. And we're currently looking for a new home to continue on the ever-changing event that is Too Much Light, creating it every week and performing 30 plays in minutes, with a certain number of them changing every week, right here in Manhattan.
And it has to be near a pizza parlor, too, in case you guys sell out
which
you usually do.
When we sell out, we order out, so we always look for a local pizza establishment to come deliver a pizza for the audience. It's another element of kind of the authenticity, the actual real life entering the stage, where we get a pizza guy, unbeknownst to him, to come and deliver a pizza on stage to the audience during the show, right in the middle of the show.
And let me ask you something, and this question has racked me since I first saw Too Much Light, probably, I guess it was 1989, maybe 88, you know, that long ago.
Yeah.
But when, is there any possible way that a show like that could play commercially, that you could bring it to a small Broadway house and make it work?
People have suggested that over the years, obviously. I mean, I think it could work. I mean, it would work like All in the Timing or something. We would just get a series of choice nuggets of you know, great plays that just work and perform them in a random order, you know, every night, but stick with those plays I mean, the only thing is part of the neo-futurist aesthetic is both the immediacy but also a sense of planned obsolescence, that nothing sticks around forever, that always we've also been rehearsing for 17 years, not just performing,
right?
Because we put in 2 to 12 new plays every single week, and I think
I don't think you would even want to lose that in a Broadway set. I mean, maybe it would be 3 new plays a week. You know, they're all short, so if they really bomb, you know, who cares? But the point is, could it be done in the sense where also, instead of being whatever it is now, $10 plus the roll of a die, it would be, say, $25 plus the roll, but not $100, because that no one, $100 wouldn't work for this, no offense.
Right.
I mean,
the
experience that I had was worth $100, but, you know, I'm broke, so I couldn't do it.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you kept it structured the way it is now and put it in like a Broadway setting, I think the challenge would be to still get the sense of process, not product. It would have to be taken very well. I don't know. I wonder about whether the pressure of success would crush the experimentality of it. I mean, I think we've been able to operate in Chicago so successfully for 17 years because there's this sense that it is still a Monpa organization. I'm still there on stage, and I'm...
So you're still physically doing it. You know, you're the founder, but you're still at it.
And I'm washing the dishes, and I'm, you know, whatever, sweeping the stage, and whatever. There's really that sense of we're all just people. We're not movie stars. We're not Broadway stars. We're just people exploring our lives.
Well, Greg Kogas is making a little bit, you know, I should have mentioned that some of the people who were in those early years have gone on to some other things. I mean, first of all, you teach, right? You're at, what, Northwestern? Where are you?
I teach at the University of Chicago, and I taught at Columbia College for 5 years in Chicago, and I kind of job out. I mean, recently I've been teaching a lot more residencies around the country. I come in and teach for 2 weeks and kind of instruct people in the bases of neo-futurism and create a show with a bunch of college or high school kids. I'm actually about to embark to Actors Theater of Louisville, where I've taught before, and work with the apprentices to create a show.
And some of the other people are, I think, Lucia Struss does a lot of stuff in Chicago theater.
Lucia Struss has actually moved out to the West Coast and is doing films and TV, as well as theater, and coming back to Chicago to do big equity shows periodically.
And of course, Greg Kogas may be the best known because he was responsible for Urine Town, with Mark Holman, and then Eat the Taste, which I had a run here for about half a year as well. So, you know, there is a sense that it has served as a starting off point or a leaping point for some very cool people.
And Spencer Caden, who is the star of Urine Town also, of course.
Yes, absolutely. So, what lies ahead? I mean, I assume it's an open run. I assume it's going to stay in Chicago as long as you guys can keep it going. Hopefully come here in the fall. Any other outposts or furtherances?
Outposts is kind of the new approach to doing this. Yeah, I'm looking at various other cities around the country as well. We're looking at Seattle and Boston and San Francisco and Cleveland and all different places for potential outposts and branches of Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. Either working with an extant theater company and giving them the rights to create the show every week with oversight from me and some neo-futurists, or actually starting a company like we have in Manhattan where, you know, I come in and cast people and then get it up and going. So we've been exploring all different ways of looking at expanding Too Much Light so that more people can experience it besides the 500 people a week in Chicago, so that, you know, so that the art form itself spreads, as well as shows like The Last 2 Minutes of Complete Works of Henrik Ibsen, or the show I did at the New York Fringe 2 years ago, four years ago, actually, was the complete lost works of Samuel Beckett as found in an envelope partially burned in a dustbin in Paris, labeled never to be performed, never, ever, ever, or I'll sue from the grave.
Saw that. It was very funny, yeah.
That show seems to never die. We did it at the Fringe. We had another run in New York. We did it in Edinburgh. We then were brought into London to perform at the Riverside, and then had a 3-month UK tour. And there are various other shows that we have that we can tour around with as well.
Well, gosh, I mean, I'm thrilled that it is having such and taking on such a life for what is it really, you know, just a wonderful little small idea, and has
it really
remained that, you know.
I mean, and that's part of it. It's a very bare bones, simple approach to theater. It's just saying, well, theater is about people. How do we really make it about people? And that's really just the nature of what I started with. And now I get to bring it to people through teaching around the country and through various shows and performances.
Well, Greg Allen, it has been great to have you talking about that wonderful show and all the really fun and inventive and different and exciting kinds of theater that you do, and talking about that with us in the neighborhood. And one last question.
Yes.
Will there ever be a time, do you think, when either Too Much Light will need to do some different things in order not to get, I won't say stale, but the whole point of it when it first started was that it was like out of the blue, it was different, it was something, and yet now people know it's 30 shows, 60 minutes, pizza, roll the dice, name tags, the whole... It has its own sort of this happens. Will there ever be a time when you either need to create something totally else in that Italian futurist tradition, or maybe throw some monkey wrenches into the original to say, everybody wake up, something new?
We've always thought it would be really fun some night for the audience to come in and instead of a clothesline numbered 1 through 30, just to have one up there, one digit, just the one. And we pull it down and just do Miss Julie by Strindberg or something. And let's see how that audience would respond. We've also always toyed with the idea of doing the same play 30 times.
Oh, well.
Let's see how the audience responds.
That's much more Andy Kaufman-esque, you're going for there.
Well, he's a genius. That's a good inspiration, I think. I think that the nature of it is that the structure remains solid, but everything you can do with inside of that obviously sustained us for 17 years and kept it very fresh. And I don't hesitate to say that structure that is too much light can easily sustain another 17.
I have to agree. I think it's wonderful. I can't wait till it comes back to New York because it's been too long since I've seen it. It's the kind of show that you go to see to refresh your batteries as a theater goer and even as a person. I really feel, you know, I'm not just schmoozing. That's how I feel about that show. And I'm so grateful to you, Greg Allen, for creating it and talking about it with us on Dave's Gone By.
Well, thanks so much, Dave.
Statement. Question?
Agreement.
Reassuring statement. Confident statement. Overconfident statement.
Question?
Elaborate defensive excuse.
Half-hearted agreement.
Insecure statement. Distracted statement. Absurd statement.
Clarification question?
Panicked explanation. Quick, meaningless, comic non sequitur. Fake laughter. Accidental compliment of physical characteristics.
Please respond.
Shocked continuation of meaningless comic non sequitur. Relief laughter. Self-assured agreement and denial. Exaggerated statement. Grossly exaggerated statement.
Clarification question?
Extremely exaggerated elucidation.
Mental compliment with accidental double entendre.
Oh, constant laughter. Confident, suggestive proposition.
Violent denial.
Aghast repetition as question.
Disgusted, violent denial.
Defensive, incriminating implication.
Offended retort.
Aggressive, childish insult.
Disbelieving rhetorical question.
Aggressive, childish insult. Aggressive, childish insult.
Okay, so your business proposal has been typed, proofread, photoshopped, and given a nice cover. Now, all you need is 20 spiral-bound copies and 1,000 printings of your latest brochure. Your Xerox can't do it. Your mailroom can't do it. Hewlett Minuteman Press can do it all. Your one-stop printing shop, Minuteman, 1315 Broadway in Hewlett, open 6 days a week, 10% off for Dave's Gone By listeners. Family-owned Minuteman. Their service can't be duplicated. Sunday nights at 7 on WGBB, Joe Salzone hosts a fast-paced hour of news and opinion, Worldview, which includes my theater segment, Broadview. Every Sunday at 7, it's Joe's Worldview, and welcome to it.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Well, I know you've all been waiting for my scintillating commentary on Hurricane Katrina and her waves. Sometimes I do these shows a week or so in advance, however, so although I try to be timely, there can be a lag between, say, a disaster and the jokes I make about it. For example, when I wrote that song Dead Popies, Pope John Paul II was still alive, just barely, but still able to drool out the window. By the time the song got on the air, however, he was gone and the Nazi was in. And that's kind of what happened 2 weeks ago also, when I did a Dave Goes Off segment about oil and gas prices, how the oil companies were gouging and cheating us, reaping profits over and above what their actual higher costs are per barrel. And it was certainly relevant, but when I did the bit, it was before Katrina and a little before Labor Day, so I talked about prices being $2.69, $2.79 a gallon, when, of course, by the time the piece aired, just a week and a half later, prices at the pump were nearly a dollar more than that. We're all going to Halliburton in a handbasket. But such is the price of pre-taping certain bits. What you gain in control and finesse, you can lose in immediacy. Anyway, that is just by way of saying I wish this song could have aired last week. I wrote it over Labor Day weekend, a couple of days after the hurricane, and by now, well, we've seen all the images of people being rescued. We've seen the engineers come in, the military restoring order. So the initial, oh my godness, of the situation is already starting to fade, which is unfortunate because had the rescue process simply started 72 hours earlier, we'd all be pretty proud of our government and our state bureaus, not to mention having saved a few extra dozen lives. Oh, but why quibble? Especially when you can sing.
Hurricanes start tearing things down, and water begins to rise up past my face. I climb way up to the top of my house as all my things drift off without a trace. On the roof I've lived for 3 days straight, hoping for some help before it's too late. Wait and wait and wait, I got no food and I don't got no phone, and facing street smells just like a zoo, just like a zoo. Gangs of kids are stealing TVs and all the cops I see are looting too. All I do is sit and pray and cry and count the bloated corpses floating by. Hold your nose up on the roof. My Lord, just wasn't prepared for the situation. If you're poor and black and the levee walls crack, the president just goes back to his vacation. One day I know things will be alright, but only when the White House is no longer white. And that's the truth from on the roof, up on the roof.
Psst, you wanna buy a watch? No? How about a dishwasher? Vacation in Europe? Well, what's wrong with selling my stuff this way? How else? Advertise on Dave's Gone By? Take a 30 or 60 second ad on the radio? I can't afford that. I can, and I'll reach thousands of listeners all over America? How do I? Dave'sGoneBy.org has all the info, huh? Great card and everything? Done deal. Hey, before I go, want to buy a raincoat full of watches?
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Want to thank my extra special guest, Greg Allen, for visiting the neighborhood. Look for Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, coming to Off-Off Broadway sometime in the fall. And Chicago listeners, go to the Neo Futurarium on Friday and Saturday late nights, or they also have a Sunday show at 7 at the Neo Futurarium on Ashland. Be prepared to stand on a line for a while. They do tend to sell out, but that just means free pizza. Too Much Light. There is no other show like it, and if you get on its wavelength, I'm sure you will become a believer, just like me. It really is a life-changing, or at least a momentarily life-enhancing experience. Thank you also to Program Director Tom Ross, and to my wonderful and neo-beautiful wife, Joyce. Thanks to Hewlett Minuteman Press for being the copy kings of Hewlett, and for sponsoring this show. Get a 10% discount on any job, great or small, at Hewlett Minuteman by mentioning Dave's Gone By. For tons of information and fun reading about Broadway and off-Broadway theater, get a copy of Performing Arts Insider magazine. It's on sale at the Drama Bookshop in Manhattan or through the website performingartsinsider.com. And if you opt for a full subscription, Dave's Gone By listeners get 10% off. Remember to catch Joe Salzone's World View program Sunday nights at 7. It's an hour about issues in the news, interviews with experts and authors, and towards the end of the show, I do a weekly theater segment called Broadview. That's Sundays, 7 p.m. on WGBB. And for 3 hours of heavy, crunching rock and roll music and light and loony comedy, put your radio on at midnight at the end of Friday for the Jimmy and Robin show. Other stuff to listen to on this radio station? Well, what about more me? 1 hour from now, at 9 p.m., I return with Filler Up, pure music, and just a little bit of yapping. But I get to pick the music, so you know it's going to be eclectic and cool and off the beaten path. Tonight on Filler Up, we celebrate the birthdays, or birth anniversaries, of people like Roy Acuff, B.B. King, Mark Anthony, Leonard Cohen, and the one and only William Shuby Taylor, the most unusual scat singer of all time. I actually did a segment about him on the very first Dave's Gone By. Shuby would have been 76 next week had he not died in a New Jersey nursing home in 2003. But he had his minor moment of glory just toward the end. In the early 1980s, he went into a recording studio several times, sometimes with either himself or an accompanist playing a Hammond or Farfisa organ, or he might bring record albums by other artists like Johnny Cash or Tammy Wynette or Miles Davis. And Shuby would either scat sing to the organ accompaniment or just scat over a pre-recorded track on a major label song. He made some cassette tapes of these performances, and somehow one tape made its way to an engineer at WFMU in East Orange, New Jersey, a radio station that has always thrived on outsider music, on the weirdest, nuttiest, what the heck is this kind of stuff. The tape became a cult item of sorts at WFMU, often played, keeping interest in Shuby alive, even though no one had any clue whether he was alive or dead, or even who he was, or what became of him, until a fan, a truly devoted fan, went through all the William Taylors in a New Jersey phone book and found him. He had had a stroke and was living in a nursing home, but he had all his faculties, or at least all the ones he had to begin with, and he was in good spirits, very vital. And there's a lovely interview with him still preserved on the WFMU website from August 2002. I highly recommend checking it out. The site is still the only place you can hear Shuby's music. It's all unreleased, though FMU DJ Erwin Schusick has been working on getting the rights to put a CD together. But the nice thing is that Shuby was located several months before he died and honored on that radio station, people calling in to tell him how much they liked his music. And remember, we're talking about music that sounded like this.
Little
Well, you get the idea. And if you like the idea, for some reason, tune in tonight at 9 for more Shuby Taylor and a bunch of other folks on Filler Up. Listen also to more Dave's Gone By right now on DFSX Radio. You can get there through my website, davesgoneby.org. They play a vintage episode of Dave's Gone By every Thursday night at 8 and repeat it at 11 Eastern. And if that's not enough Dave for you, there are shows you can listen to anytime archived on theaterpod.com. Well, time for me to make like a hurricane and blow, but I'll be back next Thursday, September 22nd, with a 143rd episode of Dave's Gone By. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Curtain. And gone by.
Loud storm! Go!